Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and usually my mother, Caroline Kilborn, sitting here beside me, but she's in sunny North Carolina today. At least I hope it's sunny down there. And I just got back from Houston, where it snowed for the first time in many years. So that was, they blamed me for bringing the snow down with me, but I don't really think it was my fault. However, our guest today might tell us a little bit more about whose fault it is. We have with us today Richard Heinberg. He's the author of 8 books, including The Party's Over, Power Down, The Oil Depletion Protocol, and Peak Everything, which is the book we're discussing today. Richard is a senior fellow of Post Carbon Institute and is widely regarded as one of the world's foremost peak oil educators. He writes a regular column for The Ecologist, has written essays for numerous magazines, including one of my favorite, The Sun, and also on websites such as alternet.org and energybulletin.net. Richard has appeared in numerous video documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour and the feature film Crude Impact. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Richard.
Hey, good to be with you, Monica.
So tell us, Richard, how did you become a leading peak oil activist?
Well, this really goes back to the 1990s. I was... I've really used writing as a way to give myself an excuse to figure out what's going on in the world, just to pursue my interest and fascination with the human condition. And so a big question in my mind was how and why societies undergo really comprehensive changes like going from hunting and gathering to agriculture and from agriculture to industrialism. And I spent a lot of time looking at history and economic theory and political history and so on, piecing together different parts of the puzzle. But it wasn't until the late 90s that I finally realized what an important piece energy is. I read an article in Scientific American called The End of Cheap Oil by a couple of European petroleum geologists. And very quickly I realized that this really is the linchpin. Energy is the essence of life itself. And as societies find more abundant sources of energy that enables them to grow in size and in complexity, and fossil fuels have been the most abundant, cheap, powerful energy source we've ever found, and that's what enabled the Industrial Revolution to happen, and it's why we're sitting here right now talking on the phone. But, of course, fossil fuels are also limited in quantity because they're non-renewable resources. So the question immediately arises, you know, when are supply problems going to appear for fossil fuels? And that article, The End of Cheap Oil, suggested that the that supply problems might be appearing much sooner than many of us had thought, and might actually be the first of the famous limits to growth that we encounter as a society. So since that time, I have basically been full time on the peak oil story.
Now, a lot of people maybe have heard or read or that we may be running out of fossil fuels, but not too many of them make that then their life mission to deal with this. Why do you think you did?
Well, I think it you know, at first when I realized the enormous importance of this, that it would impact everything about our lives and could even, unless we deal with this properly, it could be the end of civilization itself. When I understood the enormity, the magnitude of this, I became obsessed with it, but at first I thought, well, I'm probably not the right person to do anything about it because I don't have specialized training that would be relevant. I'm not a petroleum geologist. I'm not even an energy nerd. You know, I'm just a guy who writes books about, you know, trying to explain the world and figure out our place in it. More of a philosophical, eco-philosophy, I guess, would be a good general description of what I had written up to that point. But after a while, I started seeing what the experts in the field were actually writing on the subject, and I realized, you know, that there was a need for a kind of larger perspective on this that took into account economic history and political history and so on, and put peak oil in a larger context so that people could get what I was getting, you know, the enormity of this and how it was going to impact everything that we're familiar with today. So I came into this in a sense reluctantly, just realizing over the course of a number of years that somehow I had given myself a skill set that would be useful to get the message out, even though I wasn't a card-carrying, you know, petroleum expert.
Now, Peak Everything is a collection of essays that were written for various purposes, various audiences. I think some are even maybe transcripts of presentations or speeches.
That's right.
That you gave. And in one of them you talk about sort of the climate change activists versus the peak oil activists and how they don't always see eye to eye. Even though in some sense it's the same issue that they're dealing with, they don't always recognize that. Now, you seem to, even though you are bringing in points from both sides, you seem to be more on the peak oil side. Why did you choose that path rather than more on the climate change path?
Well, as I say in the essay, recognize climate change as the greatest environmental threat that's ever faced us as a species. And if we don't deal with it immediately and effectively, it could spell the end not only of human civilization, but of much of higher life on Earth. It's really that bad. However, that said, it seems to me that from a policy perspective, energy scarcity is likely to drive change sooner and faster than climate change. And the reason for that is that the whole climate discussion is oriented around something that's going to happen in the next few decades that we see as impacting other species and future generations of human beings. We've got to do this for the sake of our children and grandchildren. Peak oil is something that is going to be impacting our economy very soon, and it's not negotiable. We humans like to do things for the sake of, you know, other species and future generations. If it doesn't cost us too much, you know, if we don't have to work all that hard at it, if we don't have to give up opportunities, let's say for economic growth in the process. But as we're actually seeing in the world today, you know, we all know what a serious problem climate is. Just about everyone has agreed on that. There are a few holdouts. But when
still
it comes
it's
to
something
real
that's...
action, there's actually very little. China, for example, world's foremost greenhouse gas emitter. And so if China isn't on board with a global plan to reduce CO2 emissions, then they're not really going to achieve that much. Yet China is basing its whole economy and its political stability on rapid rates of economic growth, and that growth is based on the consumption of fossil fuels, mostly coal. They get about 70% of all of their energy from coal. So, you know, we're not really seeing much change in China or in the U.S. or even in Europe. Even after several years of the Kyoto Protocol, the world is still emitting more greenhouse gas emissions than it was a few years ago. So that's why I think that, in fact, despite all the best intentions, policy is more likely to be driven by necessity, and fossil fuel depletion, decline of availability of oil, rising prices, that's going to be something that we can't ignore, even if we don't care about future generations. We're going to have to adapt our economies to living without fossil fuels. So the question is, how do we do that proactively? How do we get that process on track?
Does it seem likely that we're going to prepare ahead of time, or just react when it actually happens?
Well, that's the big question, because if we don't prepare ahead of time, it's going to be a jarring, wrenching transition. There, of course, are economists who say that as fossil fuel prices go up, that will turn the trick all by itself. You know, higher oil prices will incentivize people to drive less, buy more fuel-efficient cars. And that's exactly what we're seeing. You know, we saw oil prices go up to about $150 a barrel this summer in July, and U.S. vehicle miles traveled have declined dramatically as a result of that.
But now the prices have gone down.
Now the prices have gone down. So what we're seeing is price volatility.
And do you have an explanation for why the price would go down if the supplies are getting less?
Sure. Yeah, the price hasn't gone down because suddenly there's more oil in the world. The price has gone down because of declining demand. Demand is declining, first of all, because those high prices were unsustainable. You know, the airlines have grounded scores of planes and, you know, we're driving less, all the rest. We all know that story. But also the world economy took such an enormous hit that it burst the mortgage real estate subprime bubble that had been inflating for some time, or helped to deflate that. It was a disaster waiting to happen anyway. And so now, as the world economy goes into a tailspin, we're seeing really dramatically declining energy consumption, and especially oil consumption. Meanwhile, a lot of hedge funds had invested in oil futures. They put their money in the commodities market because of declining property values. And now that oil prices are declining, the hedge funds are fleeing from the oil futures market. Also, they had to cover some of their losses from derivatives and so on. So now we're seeing oil prices actually collapsing to the level of, right now they're in the low $40 range per barrel. So they've lost over $100 a barrel in price.
In a few months.
In just a few months.
And
that dramatic volatility is undercutting our ability to plan and prepare for peak oil, because now new oil supply projects aren't getting funded. They can't borrow the money, and why even bother with oil so cheap? So that means that in just a few years, we're going to see an oil supply shock even worse than it would have been otherwise.
So it would have been better in the long run if the prices had stayed high.
Yes, absolutely. That would have helped us to adapt. You know, we would have known that energy prices would be at a certain level. That way, it would be wise to invest more in alternative energy sources, which would have been more profitable, and so on. Now, even investments in wind turbines and solar panels are falling away because, after all, you know, fossil fuels are cheap again.
Now, do you think it would make sense for a government to basically set the price of oil, and when the market price is lower, take the difference as a tax and invest it in alternative fuels?
Yes, a lot of people have suggested something like that. Just a simple carbon tax would accomplish basically what you said. And Al Gore has been talking about this for some time, for example. And we could actually replace our payroll taxes, our income tax, with a carbon tax. And that would mean that we wouldn't actually be paying any more money to the government as individuals or companies. It would just be traveling through a different route, which would disincentivize the use of fossil fuels and help us all to adapt to the inevitable future.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Richard Heinberg, the author of Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines. So, Richard, once you became obsessed about this issue, I'm curious about how you changed your personal lifestyle. You know, you're obviously still flying places because you're, you know, you're talking to people and you're using electricity and so forth. Did you make any major changes yourself?
Well, yes, and I'm continuing to make changes. I'm flying a lot less and doing more of my presentations by way of video teleconference, for example. And for the last 8 or 10 years, my wife and I have been making our house as energy efficient as possible. We live on a quarter-acre lot in an inner city suburb, so we can actually walk to the center of town, even though we're living in a in an old suburb. And we grow about 25 fruit and nut trees, and we have about a dozen garden beds. We have solar panels on the roof of our house. We collect rainwater. And I have to say, you know, having spent 10 years doing all of this, we're still not done. It's a process. It requires, you know, effort and time, planning. We still haven't gotten, for example, to the solar hot water system. It's on our list of things to do, but with all the other things we're doing, we just haven't fit that in yet. So I totally sympathize with people who see this as a, as, you know, just more than they want to take on. But the reality is, you know, we're all going to be caught up short in not too long, because we are so dependent on these fossil fuels, not only for transportation, but also home heating.
Right.
You know, what are we all going to do, those of us who live in cold states like Iowa, when natural gas starts to become much more expensive and heating oil in the Northeast? We should be super insulating millions of American homes right now.
Right.
Right, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. And if back in the 70s, of course, fuel prices went up for a while, and it seemed like there was a lot of attention on alternative forms then. A lot of people around here started heating with wood.
That's right.
At that point. Now, I don't think that's very sustainable either, because we've decimated so much of the forest here.
Right. Yeah. Well, wood, of course, is a renewable resource, but it's an exhaustible source.
Right.
If everyone in the Northeast, for example, started heating with wood, that northeastern forest, which is regrown largely since the 18th and 19th centuries, when it was cut down to provide arable land and also for fuel and building materials and so on, that regrown forest would be gone in, by some calculations, 3 or 4 years.
Whoa.
Started heating with wood.
Wow, that's not very long. Well, Richard, why did you decide to write Peak Everything? You know, you'd written a number of other books. What was different about this one that
right.
made you want to?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the peak oil discussion was starting to get out into the mainstream. It took several years of banging on that drum before, Wall Street Journal, CNN, and mainstream outlets like that would even begin to discuss the reality of short-term problems with oil supply. But I've always understood from the very beginning that peak oil was only a facet of a much larger problem, which I've called the universal ecological dilemma of population pressure, resource depletion, and habitat destruction. And so now that peak oil is starting to be understood by a larger percentage of the population, I thought it was important to place that subject back in the larger context to understand that it's not just that we're running out of oil. We're running out of lots of renewable and especially non-renewable resources. And the reason for that is that there are so many of us, and we're using so much so fast. So until we really get that larger picture dealing with peak oil, you know, we may throw some really silly strategies at it. We might try to deal with peak oil, for example, by making liquid fuels out of coal, which can be done. You know, the science is there. But then we have to look at, well, how much coal do we actually have? You know, we're told constantly that we have 200 years worth of coal, but
that's at current usage rates.
That's at current usage rates, and also that assumes that somehow we'll be able to continue using it at a constant or growing rate until one day it just all runs out, which, of course, is nonsensical. As with oil, our coal consumption will follow kind of a bell curve. We'll use the cheap, easy stuff first. We'll get the highest quality resources out of the ground, which we've done. And then our use of coal will reach a maximum and then begin to decline. So when's it going to peak? And the best studies that we have so far on that suggest that U.S. coal production will peak around 2025 to 2035, somewhere in that range. And that's not that far away.
Right.
So we can't solve peak oil by just moving to coal. And you know, this obviously there's a lot to discuss here. We could look at a number of other important resources that we rely on, but the big picture is basically the only way we're going to get out of this ecological dilemma is to begin to rein in our human numbers and our rates of consumption.
Now, the issue of population control has been controversial for a long time. And as I was reading some of the essays in Peak Everything, where you were talking about some, you know, simpler, more horticultural lifestyles and so forth, it occurred to me that most of the people who promote that type of lifestyle now also promote large families.
Well, I would say many do.
Yeah, many do. And so then
most
isn't
is
that
true.
Sort of...
And that's very unfortunate. Because we live on a finite planet. And as our population grows, it makes all of our other problems worse. It makes our political freedoms more diluted. You know, if the population of the U.S. is, as it was at one time, only 50 million people, then every member of Congress, every senator represents so many people. If the U.S. has 300 million people, as it does now, that means that each of those representatives has that many more people that they're responsible for, and our voices, our ability to impact policy, whether at the local level or at the national level, gets watered down. It gets diminished over time. So overpopulation hurts us there. It hurts us in terms of our ecological sustainability, our ability to feed a growing population, on and on. We pay a very high price for population growth, but we don't pay much attention because we assume that it's just something that's inevitable. It's been going on for a couple of hundred years now, so we just tune it out.
You also
can't afford to do that.
Make a point that when there's so many people, that the value of life becomes less.
That's right.
That an individual life becomes devalued, and you can, you know, we hesitate to see that in our own culture, but we maybe can look at other cultures more easily and see that situation where violence or infanticide are prevalent because there's just so many people that what difference does one more or less make?
Right, right. And it's important to keep both elements of this equation in mind, both consumption levels and population levels. If we only talk about one side of that equation, then we miss out. And we can end up blaming others for a problem that actually we're all complicit in. Here in North America, high consumption levels are what's driving our impact on the planet. And in other countries, well, let's say India, for example, India is suffering horrendous environmental devastation because of their high population. Now, we can't talk people in India, or can't suggest to people in India that they should lower their consumption rates. That's not going to help their situation. They're already consuming at on average a very, very low level, just enough to sustain life. But overpopulation is hurting their survival chances, and so it's in their interest to reduce population, just as in fact it's in our interest to reduce our population in North America as well.
Now, population growth does, you know, from my understanding, does slow down when women are more educated and have more rights.
That's right.
And so that has happened in North America.
That's right.
But we still...
Most of our population growth in North America right now is from immigration and from within immigrant communities. And so we have a lot of work to do here in terms of negotiating what to do about immigration and how to educate immigrant communities to reduce their fertility rate.
And, of course, you run into obstacles with religion.
Yes, of course. Now, the main reason that we don't have a more robust discussion about population issues in the world today is the stranglehold of the religious communities, not just Christian, also Muslim, in many parts of the world, particularly in North America, that have cut off funding for family planning around the world. And we'll all be paying the price for that, I'm afraid.
Why do you think that our religious institutions are so, you know, pro having more people? What's in it for them?
There is actually a partly unconscious strategic imperative to all of this. And it's not only religion, it's also political in the larger sense, and that is that population growth is a kind of demographic weapon. The groups, the religions, the ethnic groups that are able to reproduce faster then ultimately gain power within within communities and within nations. That's not, you know, one could, I suppose, find historic counterexamples to that, but it's been true so many times that one sees it at work in really in the world today. And this is not to say that this kind of discussion is, it's so easy to make it seem as though it's one that is blaming ethnic groups for high population growth rates. I think we have to understand the human, very, very real human motivations that that underlie these things. Fear of being unable to support oneself in old age often makes people in poor societies want to have more children, so there are more people to pick up the slack.
Right.
But we have to solve these basic human problems, and it's going to require negotiation, political, economic negotiation to do that.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Richard Heinberg, author of Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines. Richard, how would you describe this book in 60 seconds?
Well, it's a look at the human condition at the beginning of the 21st century, taking fully into account the fact that we are at a historic cusp, where the 20th century was all about more extraction, more population growth, and we've reached the end of that road. So the 21st century is going to look very different from the 20th. So how do we accommodate ourselves to that? How do we change our thinking and our behavior so that the 21st century is a period of controlled contraction that we and the environment can both survive?
Now, some of the pictures that you paint in here about potential future are pretty scary.
Right.
And how do you educate people about this without overwhelming them into a state of hopelessness?
Right. Well, it's always a challenge. Sometimes I wonder, you know, is this even a good thing? Are people just traumatized by this information and unable to do anything about it? Fortunately, I've been at this long enough to understand that what we're really looking at is a process of adaptation, psychological adaptation. When people first understand what direction we're headed as a species in our environment, there is a period of first of all, denial, usually, and then anger and fear and sadness and grief. And ultimately, that culminates in acceptance and application of oneself to making a difference. Now, some people get stuck in one stage or another along the way, either in denial or anger, and that's not very productive. So my job as an author is to help people go through that whole series of stages of psychological accommodation to where we all get together at the end, which is not only acceptance but also application of ourselves, doing something to change.
Now, Richard, one of the aspects, or one of the, several of the essays in the book, dealt with this You talked about the historical change from hunter-gatherer to horticultural to agricultural to industrial to post-industrial societies. And I found that really interesting. And one of the things I found very interesting about it was, as you know, we have this idea that the way we live now is the best it could possibly be.
Right.
And that anything else was inferior. And yet there are some suggestions that some of these earlier lifestyles maybe had, there were things that were superior to them about than to the lifestyle we have now. Particularly the hours of leisure, which really shocked me because I always had this assumption that those earlier forms of civilization were mostly about survival and that's all they had time to think about.
Right. Well, it would be wrong to paint earlier tribal societies, hunter-gatherer societies, horticultural societies, and so on as being, you know, somehow ideal and with not having any problems at all, like interpersonal violence or periods of lack and want and even famine, because all of those things were present. They certainly had their problems. However, we've tended to go to the other side and say, well, you know, all they did was struggle for existence all the time, and now we get to sit back and watch TV and go to the grocery store and buy our cheap food, and so life is so much easier. Well, it's true, life is easier in a lot of ways, largely as a result of the cheap, abundant energy of fossil fuels that does all this for us. However, when you look at quality of life, you know, how much leisure time we have, our sense of engagement with our families, our local communities, the amount of human creativity we are or were able to apply to the various problems around us, you know, in many ways we don't really have it any better than folks in previous times. Just one gauge. I mean, when I start going down this direction, someone will always say, yes, but they only live to be 35 years old or 25 years old or whatever. And, of course, that's a statistical average. You go back any number of centuries, and there were still people living into their 80s and 90s. It's just that along the way, a lot of folks got picked off by disease or by accidents. And so the average longevity was less. Well, so if we've increased the average human lifespan, that's a good thing. But nevertheless, I think we overestimate in some ways the increases in quality of life that we've been able to achieve.
And of course, increasing the average lifespan also increases population density.
Yes, that's true too.
And probably nobody really wants to think about that.
Right. Well, then there's the question of our modern healthcare system. To what degree is it sustainable in an energy-constrained world?
Mm.
We've been able to do amazing things to prolong human life, but often, you know, the last few weeks or days or months of life are the most... it require the most resources and money, just frankly, to prolong.
And often the recipients of that medical care aren't really all that interested in prolonging.
That's right.
But we've become a society that feels like we have to do whatever we can do.
That's right. And the reality is we're going to be seeing more and more as we go along that we simply can't afford to do that. So we're going to have to think, what is the best allocation of the resources that we have for healthcare? And certainly prevention of disease and disability is, I think, going to be our first priority, and then dealing with epidemics, which are becoming more and more of a real likelihood, public health, and then these extraordinary measures that we put into prolonging life in situations where there's not really a very good prospect anyway. I think we're going to have to do some rethinking in those situations.
That'll be a tough one.
Yeah.
Richard, would you like to share a section of Peak Everything with our listeners today?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The last chapter in the book is about language, because I've come to think that language is really the key to so many things. We have become human beings as a result of our ability to string together otherwise meaningless symbols and sounds that we give meanings to on a more or less arbitrary basis, and we create mathematics and literature, and we use language to help us make more sophisticated tools. And in the end, I think it's language that has made us such a powerful species. So in that chapter, I have a section called Language and the Ecological Dilemma. And I'll just go ahead and read that now.
Great.
The ecological dilemma, which consists of the mutually rebounding impacts of population pressure, resource depletion, and habitat destruction, is certainly not unique to modern industrial humans. Indeed, it's not unique even to humans per se. However, modern humans have created a dilemma for themselves of unprecedented scope and scale. The dilemma, whether encountered by people or pigeons, is often a matter of the failure of success. The genetically ingrained aims of the organism are to reproduce and to increase its energy capture, but its environment always has limited resources. Thus, temporary population blooms, which are, in their way, evidence of biological success, are usually followed by a crash and die-off. In humans, the powers conferred by language, tools, and social organization have enabled many boom and bust cycles over the millennia, but the recent fossil fuel era has seen so much growth of population and consumption that there's an overwhelming likelihood of a crash of titanic proportions. This should be glaringly obvious to everyone. Our ecologists have studied population blooms and crashes in other species. Our soil scientists appreciate the limits of modern agriculture. Our geologists understand perfectly well that fossil fuels are finite in quantity. And our mathematicians can easily calculate exponential growth rates to show how quickly population increase and resource depletion will outstrip our ability to satisfy even the most basic human needs. Verbal and mathematical logic, joined with empirical evidence, make an airtight case. We're headed toward a cliff. But language also keeps most of us in the dark. This is partly because magical thinking is alive and well, and not just in churches and New Age seminars. In the last couple of centuries, the magical thinking associated with religion, under assault from science, has found a new home in political and economic ideologies. Economics, which masquerades as a science, began as a branch of moral philosophy, which in fact it still is. For free market ideologues, the market is God, and profit is the ultimate good. We've used language to talk ourselves into the myth of progress, the belief that growth is always beneficial, and that there are no practical limits to the size of the human population or to the extent of renewable or even non-renewable natural resources we can use. This particular myth was an easy sell. It's an inherently welcome message, a version of the you can have your cake and eat it too idea. And it seemed to be confirmed by experience during a multi-generational period of unprecedented expansion based on the one-time-only consumption of Earth's hydrocarbon stores. Meanwhile, at the business end of economic theory, masters of advertising, marketing, and public relations have learned deftly to manipulate symbols and images for emotional effect, sculpting the public's aspirations for comfort and prestige. This new kind of magical thinking did contribute to commerce and industry, and spectacularly so. In politics, the 20th century saw battles between the quasi-religious ideologies of the left and right, Leninism, Stalinism, fascism, Nazism, and Maoism, along with British, it's for your own good colonialism, and equally benevolent Yankee imperialism. In recent years, the political philosophy of Leo Strauss and his followers has come to the fore via the neoconservative members of the current Bush administration. Strauss taught a doctrine that's really just the explicit utterance of an implicit belief among common among ruling elites, that it's the duty of wise leaders to cloak their policies in potent patriotic and religious symbols and myths in order to galvanize the internal ethical imperatives of the masses. In other words, lies, if told by the right people for the right reasons, are not only good and necessary, they're the very foundation of responsible statecraft. On this basis, however, language ceases to provide a tool set for accurately mapping the world and instead becomes a mental haze enveloping society, preventing us collectively from grasping our situation. Only the rulers are expected or allowed to know the true score, but all too often they come to believe their own myths. And so we live today in a fog of words so thick that it largely prevents us from seeing where we are or where we're headed. Language helps us understand and at the same time prevents understanding. It enables reason and rationality, yet also frustrates them. Simply put, language magnifies all of the conflicting priorities and potentials of the human organism.
You've been listening.
I go on from there to suggest how, you know, language is also basically our only lifeline to the future. We've got to use language more carefully and accurately to map where we are and to communicate that and to map out our strategy for getting from where we are today to a sustainable world in the future.
That was Richard Heinberg reading from Peak Everything on Writer's Voices. Richard, I'm just imagining how you must have felt when some of our political leaders in this election cycle were chanting, "Drill, baby, drill."
Yeah. I did a number of television interviews during that time, often debating with folks from think tanks in Washington who were saying, "Oh, you know, this is what we need to do in order to solve our energy problems. Go out there and drill." And it was always sad to see, you know, this line being put forward, which is basically a complete distortion of the reality. I mean, here we are in the most thoroughly explored region of the planet in terms of oil. We used to be the world's foremost oil producer and exporter. Our domestic production has been in decline for 35 years. Discoveries of oil in the U.S. have been declining since 1930. And yet we believe that by doing a little more drilling, we can solve the problem. It's really, as I was saying in the passage I just read, it's the use of language not to clarify, but to really just to pull the wool over.
And it does seem like I can recognize a lot of that in recent years. But one of the things I think that people resist the message that you're giving is that this message has been presented before over the decades and centuries, and things didn't turn out as badly as the predictors predicted. So how do you address that? I mean, for example, my father believed that we would have an economic and societal collapse by 1980, and moved. That's how I ended up in Iowa. He moved his family from the East Coast out here to Iowa, bought a farm where he could totally live off the land if need be, and set about, you know, building a pond and planting fruit trees and nut trees on acres and acres for that eventuality, which did not occur.
Yeah, but I think you're going to be much better off as a result of that.
Probably.
I think you'll be very glad that your father did that.
And I do still grow, you know, I have my backyard with my raspberry bushes and my plum tree and serviceberry tree and strawberries and all those things, so it did rub off on me, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, once it's clear that we're in a fundamentally unsustainable situation, then the question is, well, at what point do we see that unsustainability translate into some form of societal contraction or collapse? And people have been able to read that handwriting on the wall for some time. And back in the early 1970s, we had a the very first application of computer modeling to population and resource depletion. That was the Limits to Growth Study of 1972. And it, in effect, it predicted a general collapse sometime in the middle of the 21st century. Now, the whole idea of limits to growth was so antagonistic and anathema to conventional economic theorists that they piled on, and they wrote articles for the Wall Street Journal and The Economist and so on, in which they did something intellectually very dishonest. They took sentences and numbers out of context from the book, and they used them to try to argue that the limits to growth study was had been somehow disproven or debunked. And they did this all through the 1980s. So today, most people think, well, you know, those people were crying wolf, you know.
They
were saying the world was going to end, and it hasn't, so, you know. But if you go back and read the original study, they weren't saying that the world was going to end in the 1980s or that we would run out of oil in 1975 or something like that. They were actually looking forward to the middle of the 21st century. And I think a lot of us back then, when we first realized that resources were limited and population growth was setting us on a trajectory toward catastrophe, assumed that, you know, the catastrophe would happen immediately, would happen very soon. In fact, the only way we're able to put numbers to these things is by very carefully studying rates of depletion, sizes of resources, size of population, and engaging in some pretty complex analysis. And that takes human power, it takes time. And so as time goes on and we have more data and our analytical processes become more sophisticated, it's possible for us to, I think, make much more accurate forecasts of how soon and in what way things are likely to change. And so I feel like I've been benefiting from that process of refinement as I've collected material for my books.
And, of course, if you're successful in getting your message across and people's behavior changes, then that'll change the eventual outcome. And so it's like if you're really successful, then your predictions will have been wrong.
That's right. that's the whole point of all of this anyway. I mean, the limits to growth people weren't gleeful that somehow society was headed toward the cliff. They were trying to sound the alarm to get us to change. Unfortunately, since the early 1970s, we haven't changed direction substantially, and we're still pretty much on the same path we were then.
Well, Richard, let's switch gears a little bit in the few minutes we have left and talk about your writing process.
Sure.
When you sit down to write a book, well, in this case, write an essay, do you have all the information already at your fingertips and you're just organizing it, or do you actually research the topic specifically that you're going to write about?
Yeah, I seldom have all of the information that I need when I start the writing process. And usually I'm writing about things that where new information is coming out all the time. So I just finished, for example, a book on global coal supplies that will be published this spring. And, you know, just as I'm finishing up the last chapter, the global economic crisis hits, and suddenly all of the trends that I'm talking about of increasing coal prices and so on, suddenly those start to go into reverse. Well, that means I have to go back through the whole book and find all of the instances where I've talked about coal prices and trends in prices and update those parts of the book to reflect what's been happening just in the last couple of months. So, yeah, it's an ongoing process of research.
And how do you organize your research materials so that you can find them and put them in the right place in the book?
That's always a challenge. You know, when I wrote my first book back in the 1980s, I was doing it by way of library research and Xerox copies, and I would, you know, quickly fill up filing cabinets full of Xeroxes and hopefully somewhat carefully organized with file folders and so on. These days, it's all on my computer, and so I have to back up my hard drive all the time to make sure that that information stays there and stays organized. And, you know, I don't know how many gigabytes I have at this point of articles that have been collected. Even if I am working with books or other print material, I'll typically try to find I'll try to put that material into electronic form so I can archive it and access it.
Have you found a system that allows you to search through these various archived materials that are maybe in different forms? You might have some PDFs and some Word docs or whatever. Is there anything that allows you to search through all of them to find what you want, or do you have to remember what book or article something's in?
Well, I try to do my best in terms of categorizing and making file folders and folders within folders and so on. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, memory really plays a huge role in this. If you see something that you think is going to be relevant at some point, you have to be able at that later point, whether it's weeks or months later, to remember what that was and where you put it.
Right, right. It would be nice, you know, it'd be nice if there was some like mega file searching software. Maybe there probably is.
Well, there is. I use a Mac, and I can do word searches for basically everything on the hard drive.
Mm.
But still, you know, you have to know what you're searching for.
Right, right. I've found that too. You know, switching like in tax research when we switched from books to online, that in some ways the book index was an easier way to search for things than having to figure out what the keywords were going to be that you needed to search.
Right.
Yeah. How did you decide how this book should be structured?
Well, that was an interesting process because I had gotten to the point where I had a number of essays that I was particularly happy with, and so then it was the question of, well, how can I create a context for these? How can I put them together in a way that makes sense for the reader? And so then it was a matter of seeing what the if there was a kind of progression of ideas that could be helpful, and if there were groupings of essays that could be done so that you know, if you have two or three together that are investigating a particular topic, you know, can you combine those into a section and so on.
And how long was that whole process? How long did that take?
Well, putting the book together actually took about three or four months. Writing all of the individual essays, that occurred over the course of a couple of years. But then when it came to actually putting the book together, that was a job of about 3 or 4 months.
Now, Richard, how did you find your publisher?
Well, I've been working with New Society for, 6 years now. I had worked with other publishers previously, once I realized that I needed to change publishers because the subject matter I was writing about was changing, and my previous publishers, you know, were not addressing the kind of subject matter that I wanted to address. Basically, I looked in my library and went to bookstores and looked at all of the books that were relevant to the topic that I was interested in writing about, and looking at the books that expressed themselves along lines that I could relate to, and again and again I saw New Society's name coming up, so they were the first publisher I approached.
So you chose them?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fantastic. Well, Richard, I have a question I haven't really asked before, but on the show, but because of the topic, I think it's relevant. Do you think there will be a role for writers in the late 21st century, and how will it be different from the role of writers today?
Well, I hope there will always be a role for writers. And I think there will. You know, as I was saying earlier, we are a linguistic species. I mean, that's what makes us human. And so as long as we're around, we're going to have a need for some of us to specialize in using language to make sense of where we're going, what we're doing. And so I think, you know, there will be as much of a role for writers 50 years from now or 100 years from now as there is today. And writers will have, I think, the same burden of responsibility that they do today, which is really to get it right. You know, to not just to push a particular ideology or belief system, although that's inevitable, you know, that's also part of being human. But I think there's a bigger responsibility of writers, which is to try to understand ourselves and the world accurately as we really are, so that we're not flying blind, so that we're not plunging into global problems using idea sets that are based on a mistaken image of the world that's built around ideology or belief rather than the attempt for accuracy.
Well, that's a very ambitious goal, because it seems like we keep doing that anyway.
Yes, I know.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a great pleasure having you here on Writers' Voices.
Yes, well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, too.
And that was Richard Heinberg, author of Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines, published by New Society Publishers. And if you're listening to us on Friday, please stay tuned for Planet Earth Wild with James Moore coming up at 2 o'clock. And I think at 3 they're playing, he'll be playing a segment that he and Stuart Tanner did, an interview with the Winnebago Indian tribe, Native American tribe. That sounds really fascinating. And if you're listening on Monday morning, please stay tuned for the Cult Show. And see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.